This is the Shell Show, starring Joe Cook.
Good evening, this is Joe Cook greeting you on a wintry night with a song in my heart, rings on my fingers, bells on my toes, and reminding you that it's always fair weather when good fellows get together. And as far as I'm concerned, there's a full moon tonight because a lot of good fellows dropped in just to entertain us. Ernie Watson with his orchestra and George O'Brien without his horse, but with lots of swell stories about making pictures in the wild and woolly west. Mitzi Green, who is a perfect echo of Mae West, George Arliss, and Fanny Bryce. Bob Pastor, the man who lasted 10 rounds with Joe Louis. And Ezio Pinza, who sends his booming bass voice to the rafters of the Metropolitan Opera House. And then... isn't that pretty? You may think that's a boy running a stick over a picket fence, but it isn't. It's Harry Brewer playing the xylophone. Boy, listen to him bring in the killing.
Come into your ranch house and join in the festivities?
Why, come right in, stranger. Make yourself to home. There ain't no door on this ranch house of ourn, and strangers is all us welcome.
Thanks for the hospitality, partner. But if you look me over closer, like, I reckon you'll find I'm not quite a stranger to you.
Well, I'll be a low-down prayer dog if it ain't my old gold-digging, cow-punching, claim-staking, movie-making pal and partner, George O'Brien. How'm I doing, George?
Well, a little more practice with that Western stuff, Joe, and you'll be foreman on the Bar X ranch. Say, tell me, where did you get that cowboy talk? Out riding the plane?
No, George, I got it in the neighborhood movie house, watching your many Western pictures. I'm one of your most friendly fans, George, and when it comes to pictures, Westerners are my meat.
And my bread and butter.
That makes a pretty good sandwich. You know, George, every time I go to see one of your cowboy pictures, I get twice my money's worth watching you round up them dog cattle rustlers on the screen and hearing those children in the audience cheer you on.
Well, I'll confess something to you, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes sneak into one of those little neighborhood houses myself, you know, where one of my pictures are playing. And when those children whoop it up and applaud, it's sweet music to my ears. And when they don't, well, I know there must be something wrong with me in the picture. You know, children are my greatest critics, Joe.
Well, mine too. George, to be really popular, one has to please the children. Santa Claus proves that.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get off the reindeer and back on the horse. Where did you learn to ride?
Well, Joe, I learned to ride when I was very young. You see, my dad was chief of the San Francisco Police Department, and he believed today's boys should be tomorrow's he-men. So he used to send me to a ranch where there was plenty of riding and a day's work.
This wasn't a dude ranch where you dude all this, was it, George?
I'll say it wasn't, Joe. Out there, I learned all the practical work of riding, roping, and herding.
Did you learn your trick riding at that ranch, too, George?
Well, very little of it, Joe. You see, I was taught most of my trick riding by the San Francisco Mounted Police Department. Do you ever ride horseback, Joe?
On and off. Mostly off. But when I was a kid, I had plenty of nerve.
Uh-huh.
I used to jump on my steed,
yeah,
dig my spurs into his flank,
yes,
smear his mane with jam, well, and start rocking like the dickens. But seriously, George, I've ridden real horses, too, and there's one thing I'd like to know.
What's that, Joe?
How to stay in the saddle. How do you do it?
Well, staying in the saddle of a spirited horse is not as simple as it looks. Especially if the horse decides to sunfish or fantail.
Sunfish, huh? That's what I catch when I fish for tuna.
No, Joe. Look, when a horse rears up on his hind legs and sends his front ones up in the direction of the sun,
uh-huh,
that's called sunfishing.
Oh, yeah.
But when he goes up on his front legs and sends his hind legs up into the air, waving back and forth like a fan, that's fantailing. Now, look, if I haven't made myself clear, I'll put you up on a horse sometime and show you what I mean.
No, I'll take your word for it, George. I'll take your word for it. But clear this up. What's the idea of cowboys wearing those big 10-gallon hats?
Well, when you're riding head-lowered through wiry brush, those big brims save many a head from being cut and many an eye from being poked. And you've got to ride through plenty of brush when you're chasing strays.
What are strays, George?
Well, Joe, they're little roaming calves that have wandered away from the main herd.
Oh, you mean little calves playing hooky, huh?
That's it, Joe.
And the cowboy truant officer wears his sombrero while he hunts them out and sends them back to school.
Yes, Joe, and the sombrero also protects the cowboy from the heat of the blazing sun and from rain, wind, and squall.
What about those horses you use in your pictures?
That's a subject I love to talk about. You know, I have 10 horses on my stable at Culver City, but none of them come up to Mike. I bought him from a chap in San Fernando Valley when he was only 3 years old.
Who, the fella you bought the horse from?
No, Mike the horse.
Oh, I know.
Now, look, he's 9 years old now, and I still mean Mike.
Yeah.
He was originally trained to be a polo pony, and he's the most sure-footed and straight-riding animal I've ever come across. I can reach over and pick up a child while in motion without the slightest doubt that Mike will ride straight and through. And that's pretty hard for a horse to keep his balance with a man like me weighing 200 pounds leaning over in the saddle.
How much do you weigh when you're not leaning over in the saddle?
Exactly the same, Joe.
Well, then why lean over? You don't gain anything by it.
Well, I don't lose anything by it.
No. I'll bet that most of that 200 pounds is muscle. How do you keep fit, George? Do you have any special diet like spinach?
No, Joe, I eat most everything, and plenty of it, too. You know, I put some mighty hearty meals away, but I manage to visit a gymnasium every day to do setting up exercises and to box and wrestle. I have a real wrestling bout in my latest picture, Park Avenue Logger, and I didn't want the villain to throw me for a loss, you know.
Yeah, but that routine doesn't leave you much time for nightclubs, does it?
That's right, Joe, and I don't miss them either. Now, don't get me wrong. I like good, clean entertainment.
Well, do you like to hear good He-Man singing, partner?
Don't know any better combination than stocked up with a mellow moon, a roaring campfire, and a hearty song.
Well, sorry I can't give you the moon or the fire on the ranch, George. But if you really like He-Man singing, get an earful of this harmony. You like that, George?
Sounds swell, Joe. If you don't mind, partner, I'll sit around your bunkhouse a while and listen to them thar cowhands wobble.
Just make yourself comfortable, partner.
You were 16,
my village queen.
My village queen.
Bye.
Humming on the honeysuckle vine, leaves
Kentucky bay.
Same men am a-coming to his little coon of mine.
Sleep, Kentucky bay.
Till the moon am shining in the heavens up above, bobolink am pining for his little lady love. You is mighty lucky, babe of old Kentucky. Close your eyes in sleep. Fly away. Fly away, Kentucky babe. Fly away to rest. Fly away. Lay your kinky woolly head on your mammy's breast. Close your eyes and shine on harvest moon up in the sky. I ain't had no love since January, February, June and July. No time, ain't no time to say. So shine on harvest moon for me and my gal.
Hildegard Halliday is a girl who is an expert horsewoman. And remember, an expert on anything is nothing to sneeze at, especially when that expert is garrulous Hildegard Halliday.
Oh, give me a horse I can ride. Give me a horse. Give me You know, Joe, that's just the way I feel today, just like a cowgirl. When I bought this riding habit, the salesman told me I really looked like a part of the horse. I was so thrilled. How do you do, Mr. Plum? Yes, I'm Mrs. Duffel, and I can't wait to take my very first riding lesson. You know, I've always adored horses. But you've got to promise me that yours won't start my hay fever again. There's something in their hair, you know. What? Oh, oh, my. Oh, is that my horse being led out now? Oh, my. Isn't he awfully big? He seems kind of active, too. Oh, I did. I out for a spirited horse. I love anything spiritual, so long as it has a sunny disposition. Mr. Plum, what's my horse's name? Spitfire? Oh, does that mean he's... Oh, nice, Spitfire. Nice. Well, look at that. He showed his teeth. Funny, I don't know if that was a smile or a sneer. What? Mount? Oh, you mean get up on his back? Oh, yes, I have to do that if I'm going to ride, don't I? Well, where's the ladder? The ladder to climb up. I can't just fly up, you know. Oh, I put my foot in the stirrup and jump? Well, I don't know. Swing him around here. I'll try. Mr. Plum, I don't think I can do it in these britches. Well, they're a little tight in the little... Yes, that's... Well, I'll try again. I don't know. I'm up. Wait a minute, something's wrong. I'm facing his tail. That isn't right, is it? The poor horse would have to run in reverse. Oh, my hay fever. It's the horse. He's filled with it. Oh, my handkerchief. I knew this would happen. Oh, we're moving. Oh, this is very nice. What's he doing? He's hopping or something. Oh, tropic. I can't get together with him. Every time he goes up, I go down. Ouch. Oh, stop him. Oh, thanks for stopping him, Mr. Plum. Your horse is ruining me. My hay fever's coming back, and couldn't I have a cushion for my... isn't there something else I could do on the horse besides trot? Canter? Oh, that sounds nice. Oh, but look, he's got that funny expression on his face again. We're off! Spitfire, go slower! I said slower! My britches are ripping! Slower! Spitfire, don't take that jump! Don't take that... Master Plum. Here underneath the horse. I'm afraid to move. Every time I do, it tickles him and he kicks me. Thank you for helping me. I think I've had enough for today. I don't want... Oh, how do you do, Lulu? You coming to ride, too? Oh, I'm not well. Well, it's just a hay fever comes and goes. Yes, I've also been on a horse. How do you do, Tilly? Oh, I'm not well. No, I'm not well at all. Well, I may look well, but nobody knows how I'm suffering. I've been thinking so much about you lately. I saw your husband lunching with such a nice-looking woman the other day. Your sister, I suppose? Oh, you don't have a sister. Well, we never know, do we? Oh, Lulu, I've been wanting to get... Oh, I'm sorry. The horse's mane got in my mouth and started the hay fever again. Oh, Mr. Plum, your horse bit. Your horse bit. This fire is contagious.
I think you'll be surprised to know how fast your oil should circulate through your motor. At low engine speed, all the oil in your crankcase should get up through your motor and back every 60 seconds. And at high speed, your oil should make that complete circuit every 25 or 30 seconds. Now, unless your oil begins flowing instantly when you start your motor, metal scrapes against metal and serious wear results. Automotive engineers say that about 75% of all the wear in your engine occurs during the starting and warming up period. But now, there's a new kind of motor oil that checks this heavy wear from starting. It's Golden Shell. It's made by a new refining process. It's both fast-flowing and tough. Golden Shell starts flowing the instant you step on the starter, gets up between those parts in your engine right away. And yet it's tougher than many slow-flowing oils. Tests show it stands up under high engine temperatures. Don't let starting take the life and pep out of your engine. Have your crankcase drained and refilled with Golden Shell tomorrow.
Who in the world is laughing like that?
Don't you know me, Joe? I'm Robinson Crusoe.
You are? Hey, Ernie Watson, who do you think this is?
Why, I know who that is. That's Robinson Crusoe.
Yes, sir. When I was a lad, I always had a yen to take a trip. So I sailed away one sunny day on a great big handsome ship. I sailed with ease the seven seas, and I never came to grief. Till I met one noon a big typhoon which dumped me on a reef. Now pretty quick I got so sick of living all alone that I took my axe and a keg of tacks and I made a saxophone. I'd sit and play day after day some sentimental song, for I had planned to form a band if anyone came along. Well, one fine night when the moon was bright, I heard the strangest sound, and something fell. It was a coconut shell. I jumped and looked around. And high in a tree, a chimpanzee had put some shells together, and he sat and played a serenade with a piece of old shoe leather. Come down, I yelled, and join the band, and call up your companions to join our tune in the light of the moon and the shade of the waving banyans. Well, a big baboon brought a big bassoon, and the elephant brought a trumpet, and the crocodile brought a big bass viol and started in to thump it. The noise we made with our serenade was heard on a ship at sea. Come on aboard, the captain roared, and sail back home with me. Our jungle crowd, we played so loud, if anyone should ask you, we never heard a single word, so there never was a rescue. So I'm still there, still blasting air, the island echoes ring, to our latest tune by the light of the moon, the organ grinder swing. Ha, 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 ha
we celebrate Lincoln's birthday. Many stories are told about the great emancipator, but there is one which stands out above all others in giving us a clear picture of Lincoln the man. It is called The Perfect Tribute and was written by Mary Raymond Shipman Andrews. On the day after Lincoln had delivered his Gettysburg Address, he was walking along a street in Washington talking to the famous orator, Edward Everett, who had spoken before him at Gettysburg.
Your speech yesterday was inspiring, Everett. I wish I had your command of language.
But, Mr. Lincoln, my poor oratory compared with yours...
Oh, come, Everett. The crowd cheered and applauded your speech. But after mine, there was silence. Nothing. It was as if I had disappointed those people who had entrusted me with the solemn duty of blessing their dead. My speech was a failure.
Well, I see that there's nothing I can say that will convince you.
No, Everett. I can recognize failure, even in myself.
Here's my house, Mr. President. Will you step in and rest a while?
Oh, thank you. The evening is mild. I have some time before dinner. I walk on alone.
Very well, then. Good night, Mr. Lincoln.
Good night, Mr. Everett.
Oh, excuse me, sir. I didn't mean to bump into you. Yeah. I didn't see where I was going.
Well, no wonder with those big tears in your eyes. What's the matter, my boy?
My brother. They say he's dying.
There they are. What's the matter with your brother?
He was wounded at the Battle of Gettysburg. It made him blind. Now the doctor says he's going to die.
Many soldiers have been blinded. They died, my boy.
But not my brother. He can't.
Oh, no. Be brave, like a good soldier.
All right. Like him. Like a good Confederate soldier.
That's the boy. Now, then, is there anything I can do?
Well, you know, I can find a lawyer. My brother wants to make his will.
Well, perhaps I might do.
You're a lawyer?
I used to practice law a little.
Could you draw a will?
I think so.
Oh, then come. Hurry, you must.
Very well. Where is your brother?
He's in the prison hospital. There in that building. Will you come now, sir?
Yes, my boy.
I'm Warrington Blair, sir. My brother's Captain Carter Hampton Blair of Georgia.
I see.
Here's the prison hospital. I can get you through, all right. All the guards know who I am. Just call me. Carter, are you awake?
Oh, is that you, Warren?
Yes, Carter. I brought your lawyer.
Good boy, Warren. Won't you sit down, sir?
Thank you.
And please sit close to me. It's awfully hard to see you without eyes.
Yes, I understand.
These attacks, they get worse.
Shall I call the doctor?
Doctor? No. There's nothing the doctor can do for me now. There's pen and ink on the table.
Here they are, sir.
Thank you, my boy.
My will is simple. All I have is to go to my little brother here, Warrington Blair. Will you write it now?
Yes. It won't take long.
Carter, I don't want anything, honestly. Just please don't...
Come on, Warren. You and I must be men.
But why must you die?
I didn't know, Warren, until this morning when you read me that speech out of the paper. Now I think I understand.
What do you mean, Carter?
Abraham Lincoln's speech. It made me understand.
Abraham Lincoln's speech?
Oh, excuse me, sir. I had forgotten you for a moment.
What did you mean that Abraham Lincoln made you understand why you're dying?
Why, there's a speech he made yesterday at Gettysburg. You haven't read it?
No, I haven't read it.
Where's the newspaper, Warren?
Here it is, Carter.
Sir, my heart is with the South, and I believe in my soul in the cause I fought for, the cause I'm dying for. But that speech at Gettysburg showed me there was a greater, a more worthy cause.
But the speech, I heard that no one applauded.
Would you applaud the Lord's Prayer? Why, when Abraham Lincoln stopped speaking, there was a long moment of reverent silence. The silence that comes after a prayer. Applause would have been sacrilege.
And you believe that the speech was not a failure?
Failure? Why, it was one of the finest speeches ever. The great throng, standing under the spell of those words in mute wonder, paid the most perfect tribute any orator has ever received.
And you found comfort in those words?
No, not comfort. Inspiration. Why?
Yes, Carter?
Read Mr. Lincoln's speech to the gentleman here.
Yes, Carter. Here. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the purpose...
Here, my boy, let me help you. Dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field, the final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. A brave man, living and dead.
Go on.
Who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us. That from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Carter! Carter! Oh, it is...
In just a moment, we continue. WEAF, New York.
That's the way to pronounce your name, isn't it?
That's right, Ezio.
Well, that's only the first name. How about your last name?
Pinza.
Well, that can't be right because it sounds just like you spell it. Now, see if I can say your whole name at once. Ezio Pinza.
You are very good, Mr. Cook.
Maybe I better teach you how to say my name now, huh? Now, Ezio Pinza, I understand that before you sang bass at the Metropolitan, you were a six-day bicycle rider. Is that so?
Sure.
Round and around didn't get you dizzy, huh?
No, I liked it. But I enjoy singing better.
And personally, I'd prefer to hear you sing than see you ride a bicycle. So enjoy yourself, Ezio. Sing.
But I enjoy singing better.
And personally, I'd prefer to hear you sing than see you ride a bicycle.
Ultima canzone by Totti.
Thank you. regina vi fate sposa, e Dio vi cane tuon con la serenata. Là nei deserti pioni, là nella valle ombrosa, o quante volte a voi l'ho ricantato. Foglia di rosa, o fiore d'amaranto, se ti fai sposo, io ti sto sempre accanto. Sposa, io ti sto sempre accanto, foglia di rosa. Torno, feste sorrise fiori, ne perderete ai nostri vecchi amori. Ma se ne prenotte giorno, piena di passione, verrà gemere dopo io mio canzone. La mia canzone, foglia di menta, o fiore di granato, nino rammenta i baci che t'ho dato.
Happens that a singer turns out to be a singer, like Ezio Pinza, but with a prize fighter, you never can tell. He may turn out to be a bicycle rider or a dancer. Now you take the case of Bob Pastor, who is now being touted as a boxing Fred Astaire, who waltzed 10 rounds around Joe Louis at Madison Square Garden a week ago Friday night. Outside of his mother, his handlers, and a few close strangers, not a soul in the world knew he'd been studying dancing. Is that right, Bob?
That's right, Joe.
Well, what gave you the idea that you ought to stand to start dancing, Bob?
Well, my managers and seconds kind of talked it into me.
Well, after seeing Joe Louis hit a few times in previous bouts, I'd say that your handlers gave you first-hand advice. They certainly were right when they figured that Joe Louis couldn't keep up with you when you came to dancing around that ring.
Yes, Joe. They told me that Louis could do only one step, a slow shuffle.
Well, there's no question about it, Bob. You waltzed rings around him. But I understand that the dance almost broke up into a fight a couple of times. Is that true?
Only once, Joe.
Once? Well, when was that?
In the 10th round.
Do you mean to tell me that you actually forgot your manners, Robert, and really shocked him?
That's what the newsreels say.
But didn't your dancing teachers reprimand you for such a breach of etiquette?
I'll say they did. They were plenty worried when I started trading punches.
I should think so. What did they say?
They kept yelling, "Keep moving, Bob. Keep moving, Bobby. Keep moving, Bob." And through the whole 10 rounds, I heard so much that I'd keep moving, Bob, I thought somebody put on a phonograph record and a needle got stuck.
Well, you certainly were an obedient boy, Robert. You kept moving, all right.
I was still standing upright at the end of the fight, though, Joe, remember?
Yeah, that's correct. And going... Yes, and you were going strong, too. Now, if the waltz... the fight... If the fight had been 15 rounds instead of 10, do you think you could have outlasted and beaten Lewis?
I have a strong hunch that I could, Joe. I hope to get the chance to prove it soon.
See, I understand that Lewis complained after the fight that you only let him hit you once. Now, that wasn't very generous of you, Bob.
I guess it wasn't, but the next time we fight, I hope to reduce that once by one.
Well, you better be careful when that next fight comes along, Bob. They tell me Joe Lewis is going into secret training with old tap-dancing Bojangles Bill Robinson.
Lewis will have to learn to tap harder than he did the last time if he wants to win the next one.
Say, some fellow told me that for your next fight with Lewis, they're going to have Ernie Watson's dance orchestra at ringside to play appropriate music. What do you think of that suggestion?
It's okay with me, Joe, if Ernie only remembers to play the right kind of swing music.
You mean swing for you and swing and miss for Lewis, huh?
That's right, Joe. They can even play Shuffle Off to Buffalo if they want to.
Well, Ernie, I guess any tune will suit Bob just as long as you keep Joe Lewis from getting up and singing "I've Got You Under Your Chin," like he did to so many others.
I certainly hope that before the night is over, they'll be playing the Joe Lewis blues.
And I'll bet you wouldn't even care if Joe Lewis was in no proper position to appreciate it. Tell me, Bob, what do you really think of those sports writers who said Lewis should hire Jesse Owens for a trainer to prepare him for his next fight with Pastor? And they're going to make the ring smaller and bank the turns so Pastor won't slip when he runs away from Lewis. And when they said Lewis should have hired a motorcycle to catch Pastor, and...
Don't rub it in, Joe. I get the idea. Those fellows kidded me a lot. But after all, the sport writers have to earn a living in their business just the same as I do in mine. A lot of them have been mighty swell of me. Some of them gave me the decision in that last fight, and others said that if I hadn't been kept under wraps, I might have scored a knockout.
Well, what do you think about that?
Well, I'd rather try to prove it than just talk about it. But I do think the fight proved one thing. When you make Lewis come to you and fight your kind of fight, he's far from the Lewis people were used to seeing. Lewis is strictly a punch-for-punch man, a counter-puncher.
You know, Bob, my uncle was a great counter-puncher.
I didn't know that, Joe.
Oh, well, it's not in the record book, but my uncle opened up the first cafeteria in New York, and he used to stand behind the counter and punch chicks. He knocked out more customers than Joe Lewis did with his counter-punching. How does that strike you, Bob?
Well, in the ring, I'd call that a foul.
Well, lucky for me, we're not in the ring. But seriously, Bob, tell me more of what you found out about Joe Lewis and your fight with him.
Well, Lewis gets set and waits for his opponent to come to him.
Mm-hmm.
If his opponent makes that mistake and stands still, it's all over but the counting of 10. But if you circle around Lewis and keep him moving so he never gets a chance to get set and he never finds you coming to him, then Joe Lewis is a long way from the terrific brown bomber the papers built him up to be.
An exploded bombshell, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say that, Joe. A fighter must be pretty good to have scored as many knockouts as Lewis. But if you make him fight your fight instead of his, you stand a mighty good chance of beating him.
Well, Bob, I think I can show you my eye to knock out Joe Lewis the next time you meet. Do you mind if I give you a few pointers?
Joe, I'll take all the good advice I can get.
Well, look, you fight him the way I fought that big fella out in Michigan. That's Joe Lewis's hometown, Detroit, one time. I'm not a great big... I'll tell you how it happened. I was walking down the street, minding my own business, when a taxicab came around the corner, and I see a big crowd gathering, so I rush and elbow my way through the people. I said, "What's going on here?" And the nice...
Thanks a lot, Joe. I'll be sure to have you in Lewis's corner the next time we fight. Now, Joe, I'd just like to say one more thing, if you don't mind.
Say anything you please. Go ahead, Bob. Speak your mind.
Thanks, Joe. Hello, Mom. Hello, babe. Don't worry. Joe Cook didn't even hit me. I'll be right home, Mom. So long.
every car driver has found out. Your chains won't keep you from slipping and skidding on an icy road so long as they're under your seat. Chains have got to be on your tires before they can do you any good. And it's the same way with your oil. It can't prevent wear on your engine so long as it stays in your crankcase. If your oil does not start flowing the instant you step on your starter, more than 100 close-fitting parts rub and grind against each other dry of lubrication. And then, naturally, there's heavy wear. Why, in fact, automobile engineers say that 3/4 of all the wear on your engine occurs during the starting period. But now you can cut down this wear and damage. You can get a new kind of oil that's both fast-flowing and tough. It's Golden Shell. It gets up between those parts in your engine right away. And yet it's so tough that it holds its body, stands up under the high engine temperatures of steady running. Get this new type oil that's where you need it, when you need it. Have your crankcase drained and refilled with Golden Shell.
There was an old woman who lived in a shoe, though lots of kind people may doubt it. And if you were one who thinks it untrue, I'll get Ernie Watson to tell you about it.
Okay, Joe. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. Short ones, all about so high. Tall ones. Short ones, tall ones, fat ones, and thin. When it came to counting them, she didn't know where to begin, so she didn't count them. No, instead, she weighed them. Each night when bedtime came around, she dumped them all in a pail. And she weighed them 2 tons, 50 pounds, and an ounce on an old fish scale. Of course, she always allowed for wear and tear and growing pounds each night. And then she could tell if they all weren't there, if their weight turned out kind of light. One night, imagine her surprise when bedtime came at 8. Well, you should have seen the look in her eyes when the scales went overweight. Thinking that some of the neighbor's kids had strayed in there for the night, she called them forth and one by one examined them under the light. First, little Willie, feeling silly, was examined from toe to head. Suddenly, Pop and out spun a top, which he had planned taking to bed. And you'd never guess from little Nell, the old woman shook out a dinner bell. Jane had a doll, and Jimmy a ball. Peter the baby, so bright and quick, was taking to bed an enormous brick. Well, one and all, to his buried pleasure, had hidden away some secret treasure. The old woman smiled, and suspicion grew as to what caused the extra weight in the shoe. Well, there were marbles and jacks and carpet tags, a chair and an old stray cat. And little Andy had sugar and candy. John had a baseball bat. The dear old lady who lived in the shoe really loved all her children and knew what to do. She kissed each cheek and patted each head and with lullaby music sent them to bed. Now the truest words that ever were said, and it goes for all girls and boys. Beds are made for sleepy heads and not for games and toys.
What do you think Shirley Temple or Jane Withers will be like when they're 16? Well, you remember little Missy Green, don't you? She was a most popular child star a few years ago, and now she's a charming young lady of 16 with more talent than ever before. Missy has been surrounded by movie stars all her life and can imitate almost all of them perfectly. Missy, I'll bet you can't imitate 4 Hawaiians.
No, Joe, that's one I'll have to leave to you.
Yeah, but you can imitate Mae West.
Oh, all right, Joe. You asked for it, and who am I to refuse you, you great big, tall, dark, and handsome 4-foot Romeo? Why, you're the sugar for my coffee, Cookie. And as far as you're concerned, I'll come up and see you sometime.
Missy? Before I take you seriously as Mae West, you'd better imitate George Arliss.
Good evening, sir. I had the extreme pleasure of making your acquaintance several years ago in London, Mr. Cook. Your droll buffoonery and whimsy witticisms are a most delightful divertissement. I also had the honored privilege of meeting your father, Mr. Cook Sr., the gentleman who arranges the tours.
That's great, Missy. Now let's have Fanny Bright.
Hello, Joey. So you're the chef in this cafeteria, huh? You ain't the chef, you're the cook. Oh, chef, cook, chef, the same difference. I'm certainly happy to see you tonight. I could dance, I could sing, I could trip the light futuristic. I'm happy like a lark in the park. Pigeons in the grass, alas. Pigeons in the grass. So what? So, let you and me should be going for a walk in the park, and we'll catching the pigeons, and instead of pigeons in the grass, alas, we'll have pigeons in the soup. Hey, hey. I know a secret, I know a secret, I know a secret.
Hey, who are you imitating now?
Well, they tell me that's what I sounded like about 7 years ago.
Well, Missy, since we've gone back 7 years, let's go back a few more. Back to the days of the most famous of all blackface comedians, Moran and Mac, the two black crows. Missy, you'll have to be Mac because the only one I can imitate is Moran.
Boy, it seems like every time there's an excursion, I'm always broke.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be broke if you go to work.
Oh, I would work if I could find any pleasure in it.
I don't know anything about pleasure, but boy, always remember that the early bird catches the worm.
The early bird catches what worm?
Why, any worm.
Well, who cares about that?
Why, everybody knows that the early bird catches the worm.
Well, what of it? What about it?
Well, he catches it, that's all.
Well, let him have it. Who wants the worm, anyhow? And what's his idea of catching the worm?
He catches the worm because he wants it.
What does he want with it?
How do I know what he wants with it?
Well, and how do you know he wants it? How do you know that?
Well, what's the idea of catching the worm if he don't want it?
Well, what's the worm's idea of being there?
He lives there.
He lives where?
He lives where he is.
Well, doggone it, I don't even know where he is. I don't know that.
His home, that's where he is.
Oh, I'd rather not hear any more about it. And which bird is early? Which is the early bird?
The first bird that gets there.
What cause is that?
Because he's the first bird there.
Yeah, but supposing some other bird got there ahead of him.
Oh, boy, you don't know anything. What's wrong with you?
Oh, I don't know. I don't feel well. I went to the doctor, and he told me what to do, but I didn't do it.
What did he tell you to do?
He told me to take one pill three times a day, but you can't do that.
What else did the doctor say?
He said my veins are too close together.
He said what?
He said I had a very close vein. But I wouldn't like that. Even if
why to play anything on this horn?
No, you can't play piano on that. You can't do that.
I played this horn in the Metropolitan Opera Company. I was the head man in that show.
Oh, you've been with better shows than that.
I hope to tell you, I played this horn in McIntyre and Heath's minstrel show. I was the head man in that show.
Yeah, I bet you were so far ahead, you wasn't even in it.
Yeah, and I played this horn in Uncle Tom's Cabin. Did you ever hear of Adam and Eve?
I heard of them, but you wasn't the head man in that show.
Just listen to those ivories respond.
You don't wear out the engine in your car while you're stepping on your accelerator. You put the most wear on your motor when you step on the starter. While starting and warming up your motor just once, you're apt to cause more engine wear than 50 miles of steady driving. Now, when your foot goes down on the starter, almost all your oil is down in the crankcase. Unless your oil starts flowing instantly, this is what happens. More than 100 close-fitting parts rub and scrape against each other, practically dry of lubrication. But a new type oil, Golden Shell, gets up between those parts in your engine right away. You see, it's made by a new refining process. It's both fast-flowing and tough. It begins flowing the instant you step on the starter. And yet Golden Shell does not break down. It holds its body under all driving conditions. Protect yourself against engine repair bills. Stop at the Shell station in your neighborhood and have the proper winter grade of Golden Shell put in your crankcase.
Well, Ben, I certainly am glad to see you got by Groundhog Day safely.
Oh, yes, Joe. I kept my hat on and nobody bothered me. I suppose you stayed indoors?
No. I haven't been taken for a groundhog since I stopped parting my hair in the middle. But I'm glad you brought the subject up because not many people know how my father came to originate Groundhog Day.
Your father originated it, Joe? Mm-hmm. Why, I thought Groundhog Day was a good deal older than your father.
It is. That's why it's hard to believe.
What?
But he really gave the idea to the groundhog. It all happened one day when my mother said...
Elwood?
Funny thing, Ben. My mother always called my father Elwood.
Why?
Because that was his name, sonny.
So that was the reason. You know, I often wondered about that myself, Ben. Well, anyway, my mother said...
Elwood, are you going to set the ashes out or will I have to do it?
So being a gentleman, naturally, my father said...
You can do it if you want.
So my mother thanked him and out she set the ashes, just like she did every Friday. Of course, I was pretty small at the time, but I helped her as much as I could.
Well, I'm sure you did, Joe.
Yes, sir. As she carried each basket out, I sat on top and held all the ashes I could hold in my hands to make it lighter.
That helped a lot, Joe.
Yeah, even more after I put my heavy overcoat on. Then I could fill the pockets, too. And just as my mother set me and the last basket of ashes down, the clock struck 2 and my father got up.
Your father was just getting up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
Well, it wasn't his fault, Ben.
Oh, you mean he overslept?
No, underslept.
Oh.
You see, he thought it was 4 o'clock, which was the time he usually got up. Except on Sundays when he slept till 5. Well, it surprised my mother, all right. She said...
Land sakes, Elwood, what you doing up so early? Sleepwalking?
And then when my father said...
No, I ain't sleepwalking. Where's my pants? I'm going out.
My mother fainted.
You mean it'd been so long since your father'd been out of the house that the mere suggestion caused your mother to faint?
Yeah, not only that, Ben. She'd given his pants away several years ago. Why, he'd been too tired to go out of the house for the past 5 years.
6 years.
All right, 6 years. So I turned to my father and said, now see what you've done. You've made Maul faint. So my father said...
I only said I was going out. I didn't say to look for a job.
And I said, no, and it's lucky you didn't. That would have killed her. Well, with that, my father started to cry. Oh, hush up, Paul, huh? And as his tears streamed down my mother's face, she came to and said...
You're going to look mighty funny in pants, Paul. You've been wrapped in a bed sheet so long. For 2 years now, you've been getting most of Mahatma Gandhi's mail.
To which my father tartly replied...
Well... I wish he'd tell his friends to write in English so as I can tell whether I'm reading his love letters or his telephone bills.
And my mother said...
You couldn't tell the difference if there was in English.
Well, sir, that made my father feel so small, he put on a pair of my pants and went out. But no sooner had the sun struck him than a terrible thing happened.
Well, don't tell me he melted.
No, sir, worse than that. He saw his own shadow and thought somebody was following him. So he dashed back in the house and into bed again. And in spite of the fact that it was the 4th of July, the next day we had 6 weeks of cold weather. And ever since then, no matter what time of the year it is, whenever my father gets out of bed and puts on a pair of pants, we have 6 more weeks of cold weather. And the first time he gets up, you just see if we don't.
Okay, Joe, we want to... a note to join Joe Cook again next Saturday, when Joe will have many more guests, including that fine actor, Gene Herschel, who plays the doctor in all the Dion Quintuplet movies, the world-famous violinist, Ephraim Zimbalist, and many others, all adding up to another big Saturday night shell show starring Joe Cook. The selection, Who is from Sunny, by Jerome Kern. Your announcer is Ben Grauer. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
It's Bulova Watch Time, 10:30 p.m., VULOVA, WEAF, New York.